Chapter 13. That night, at home, as he was prancing around the house, pretending to be tripping through cornfields in slow motion, and continually exploding with sudden laughter, Arthur thought he could even bear to listen to the album of bagpipe music he had won. It was 8 o'clock, and he decided he would force himself to listen to the whole record before he phoned her. Maybe he should even leave it till tomorrow. That'd be the cool thing to do. Or next week, sometime. Nope. No games. He wanted her and didn't care who knew it. He definitely and absolutely wanted her, adored her, longed for her, wanted to do more things than there were names for with her. He actually caught himself saying things like, "Yippee!" as he pranced ridiculously round the house. Her eyes, her hair, her voice, everything. He stopped. He would put on the record of bagpipe music. Then he would call her. Would he, perhaps, call her first? No. What he would do was this. He would put on the record of bagpipe music, he would listen to it, every last banshee wail of it, then he would call her. That was the correct order. That was what he would do. He was worried about touching things in case they blew up when he did so. He picked up the record. It failed to blow up. He slipped it out of its cover, he opened the record player, he turned on the amp. They both survived. He giggled foolishly as he lowered the stylus onto the disc. He sat and listened solemnly to A Scottish Soldier. He listened to Amazing Grace. He listened to something about some glen or other. He thought about his miraculous lunchtime. They had just been on the point of leaving when they were distracted by an awful outbreak of yoo-hooing. The appallingly permed woman was waving to them across the room like some stupid bird with a broken wing. Everyone in the pub turned to them and seemed to be expecting some kind of response. They hadn't listened to the bit about how pleased and happy Angie was going to be about the £4.30 that everyone had helped to raise towards the cost of her kidney machine, had been vaguely aware that someone from the next table had won a box of cherry brandy liqueurs, and took a moment or two to cotton on to the fact that the yoo-hooing lady was trying to ask them if they had ticket number 37. Arthur discovered that he had. He glanced angrily at his watch. Fenchurch gave him a push. "Go on," she said. "Go and get it. Don't be bad-tempered. Give him a nice speech about how pleased you are, and you can give me a call and tell me how it went. I'll want to hear the record. Go on." She flicked his arm and left. The regulars thought his acceptance speech a little over-effusive. It was, after all, merely an album of bagpipe music. Arthur thought about it and listened to the music, and kept on breaking into laughter. Chapter 14. Ring, ring. Ring, ring. Ring, ring. "Hello, yes? Yes, that's right. Yes, you'll have to speak up. There's an awful lot of noise in here." "What?" "No, I only do the bar in the evenings. It's Yvonne who does lunch, and Jim, he's the landlord. No, I wasn't on." "What?" "You'll have to speak up." "What?" "No, I don't know anything about no raffle." "What?" "No, I don't know nothing about it. Hold on, I'll call Jim."
The barmaid put her hand over the receiver and called over the noisy bar.
"Here, Jim, bloke on the phone says something about he's won a raffle. He keeps on saying it's ticket 37 and he's won."
"Nah, there was a guy in the pub here won," shouted back the barman.
"He says, have we got the ticket?"
"Well, how can he think he's won if he hasn't even got a ticket?"
"Jim says, how can you think you've won if you haven't got a ticket?" "What?"
She put her hand over the receiver again.
"Jimmy keeps effing and blinding him. He says there's a number on the ticket."
"Of course there's a number on the ticket. It's a bloody raffle ticket, wasn't it?"
"He says he means it's a telephone number on the ticket."
"I'll put the phone down and serve the bloody customers, will you?"
Chapter 15. 8 hours west sat a man alone on a beach, mourning an inexplicable loss. He could only think of his loss in little packets of grief at a time, because the whole thing was too great to be borne. He watched the long, slow Pacific waves come in along the sand, and waited, and waited, for the nothing that he knew was about to happen. As the time came for it not to happen, it duly didn't happen, and so the afternoon wore itself away, and the sun dropped beneath the long line of the sea, and the day was gone. The beach was a beach we shall not name, because his private house was there, but it was a small, sandy stretch somewhere along the hundreds of miles of coastline that first runs west from Los Angeles, which is described in the new edition of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in one entry as junky, wonky, lunky, stunky, and what's that other word, and all kinds of bad stuff, woo, and in another, written only hours later, as being like several thousand square miles of American Express junk mail, but without the same sense of moral depth. Plus the air is, for some reason, yellow. The coastline runs west and then turns north up to the misty bay of San Francisco, which the guide describes as a good place to go. It's very easy to believe that everyone you meet there is also a space traveller. Starting a new religion for you is just their way of saying hi. Until you settled in and got the hang of the place, it is best to say no to three questions out of any given four that anyone may ask you, because there are some very strange things going on there, some of which an unsuspecting alien could die of. The hundreds of curling miles of cliffs and sand, palm trees, breakers and sunsets are described in the guide as boffo, a good one. And somewhere on this good boffo stretch of coastline lay the house of this inconsolable man, a man whom many regarded as being insane. But this was only, as he would tell people, because he was. One of the many, many reasons why people thought him insane was because of the peculiarity of his house, which, even in a land where most people's houses were peculiar in one way or another, was quite extreme in its peculiarness. His house was called the Outside of the Asylum. His name was simply John Watson, though he preferred to be called, and some of his friends had now reluctantly agreed to do this, Wonko the Sane. In his house were a number of strange things, including a grey glass bowl with eight words engraved upon it. We can talk of him much later on. This is just an interlude to watch the sun go down and to say that he was there watching it. He had lost everything he cared for and was now simply waiting for the end of the world, little realizing that it had already been and gone. Chapter 16. After a disgusting Sunday spent emptying rubbish bins behind a pub in Taunton and finding nothing, no raffle ticket, no telephone number, Arthur tried everything he could to find Fenchurch, and the more things he tried, the more weeks passed. He raged and railed against himself, against fate, against the world and its weather. He even, in his sorrow and his fury, went and sat in the motorway service station cafeteria where he'd been just before he met her. "It's the drizzle that makes me particularly morose." "Please shut up about the drizzle," snapped Arthur. "I would shut up if it would shut up drizzling. Look, but I'll tell you what it'll do when it shuts up drizzling, shall I? No, blatter." "What?" "It will blatter." Arthur stared over the rim of his coffee cup at the grisly outside world. It was a completely pointless place to be, he realized, and he had driven there by superstition rather than logic. However, as if to bait him with the knowledge that such coincidences could in fact happen, fate had chosen to reunite him with the lorry driver he had encountered there last time. The more he tried to ignore him, the more he found himself being dragged back into the gravitic whirlpool of the man's exasperating conversation. "I think," said Arthur vaguely, cursing himself for even bothering to say this, "that it's easing off." "Ha!" Arthur just shrugged. He should go. That's what he should do. He should just go. "It never stops raining," ranted the lorry driver. He thumped the table, spilt his tea, and actually for a moment appeared to be steaming. You can't just walk off without responding to a remark like that. "Of course it stops raining," said Arthur. It's hardly an elegant refutation, but it had to be said. "It rains all the time," raved the man, thumping the table again in time to the words. Arthur shook his head. "Stupid to say it rains all the time," he said. The man's eyebrows shot up, affronted. "Stupid? Why is it stupid? Why is it stupid to say it rains all the time if it rains the whole time?" "Didn't rain yesterday." "Did in Darlington." Arthur paused wearily. "You going to ask me where I was yesterday?" asked the man. "Eh?" "No," said Arthur. "But I expect you can guess." "Do you?" "Yeah, begins with a D, does it? And it was pissing down there, I can tell you." "You don't want to sit there, mate," said a passing stranger in overalls to Arthur cheerily. "That's Thundercloud Corner, that is. Special reserved for old raindrops keep falling on me head here. There's one reserved in every motorway calf between here and sunny Denmark. Steer clear is my advice. It's what we all do. How's it going, Rob? Keeping busy? Got your wet weather tyres on? Ha ha!" He breezed by and went to tell a joke about Britt Eklund to someone at a nearby table. "See, none of them bastards take me seriously," said Rob McKenna. "But," he added darkly, leaning forward and screwing up his eyes, "they all know it's true." Arthur frowned. Like my wife, hissed the sole owner and driver of McKenna's all-weather haulage. She says it's nonsense and I make a fuss and complain about nothing. But, he paused dramatically and darted out dangerous looks from his eyes, she always brings the washing in when I phone to say I'm on my way home. He brandished his coffee spoon. What do you make of that?
Well,
I have a book, he went on. I have a book, a diary. Kept it for 15 years. Shows every single place I've ever been, every day, and also what the weather was like. And it was uniformly, he snarled, horrible. All over England, Scotland, Wales I've been, all around the continent, Italy, Germany, back and forth to Denmark, been to Yugoslavia. It's all marked in and charted. Even when I went to visit my brother, he added, in Seattle.
Well, said Arthur, getting up to leave at last, perhaps you'd better show it to someone.
I will, said Rob McKenna.
And he did.
Chapter 17.
Misery. Dejection. More misery and more dejection. He needed a project, and he gave himself one. He would find where his cave had been. On prehistoric Earth, he had lived in a cave. Not a nice cave, a lousy cave. But there was no but. It had been a totally lousy cave, and he had hated it. But he had lived in it for 5 years, which made it home of some kind. And a person likes to keep track of his homes. Arthur Dent was such a person, and he went to Exeter to buy a computer. That was what he really wanted, of course, a computer. But he felt he ought to have some serious purpose in mind before he simply went and lashed out a lot of readies on what people might otherwise mistake as being just a thing to play with. So that was his serious purpose, to pinpoint the exact location of a cave on prehistoric Earth. He explained this to the man in the shop.
Why?
Said the man in the shop. This is a tricky one.
Okay, skip that, said the man in the shop. How?
Well, I was hoping you could help me with that.
The man sighed and his shoulders dropped.
Have you much experience of computers?
Arthur wondered whether to mention Eddie, the shipboard computer on the Heart of Gold, who would have done the job in a second, or Deep Thought, or... But he decided he wouldn't.
No, he said.
Looks like a fun afternoon, said the man in the shop, but he said it only to himself.
Arthur bought the Apple anyway. Over a few days, he also acquired some astronomical software, plotted the movements of stars, drew rough little diagrams of how he seemed to remember the stars to have been in the sky when he looked up out of his cave at night, and worked away busily at it for weeks, cheerfully putting off the conclusion he knew he would inevitably have to come to, which was that the whole project was completely ludicrous. Rough drawings from memory were futile. He didn't even know how long it had been beyond Ford Prefect's rough guess at the time that it was a couple of million years, and he simply didn't have the maths. Still, in the end, he worked out a method which would at least produce a result. He decided not to mind the fact that with the extraordinary jumbles of rules of thumb, wild approximations and arcane guesswork he was using, he'd be lucky to hit the right galaxy. He just went ahead and got a result. He would call it the right result. Who would know? As it happened, through the myriad and unfathomable chances of fate, he got it exactly right, though of course he would never know that. He just went up to London and knocked on the appropriate door. Oh, I thought you were going to phone me first.
Arthur gaped in astonishment. You can only come in for a few minutes, said Fenchurch. I'm just going out.
Chapter 18. A summer's day in Islington, full of the mournful wail of antique restoring machinery. Fenchurch was unavoidably busy for the afternoon, so Arthur wandered in a blissed-out haze and looked at all the shops, which in Islington are quite a useful bunch, as anyone who regularly needs old woodworking tools, Boer War helmets, drag, office furniture or fish will readily confirm. The sun beat down over the roof gardens. It beat on architects and plumbers. It beat on barristers and burglars. It beat on pizzas. It beat on estate agents' particulars. It beat on Arthur as he went into a restored furniture shop.
It's an interesting building, said the proprietor cheerfully. There's a cellar with a secret passage which connects with a nearby pub. It was built for the Prince Regent, apparently, so he could make his escape when he needed to.
You mean in case anyone might catch him buying strip pine furniture, said Arthur.
No, said the proprietor, not for that reason.
You'll have to excuse me, said Arthur. I'm terribly happy.
I see.
He wandered hazily on and found himself outside the offices of Greenpeace. He remembered the contents of his file marked Things to Do, Urgent, which he hadn't opened again in the meantime.
He marched in with a cheery smile and said he'd come to give them some money to help free the dolphins.
Very funny, they told him. Go away.
This wasn't quite the response he'd expected, so he tried again. This time they got quite angry with him, so he just left some money anyway and went back out into the sunshine. Just after 6, he returned to Fenchurch's house in the alleyway, clutching a bottle of champagne.
Hold this, she said, shoved a stout rope in his hands, and disappeared inside the large white wooden doors from which dangled a fat padlock off a black iron bar. The house was a small converted stable in a light industrial alleyway behind the derelict Royal Agricultural Hall of Islington. As well as its large stable doors, it also had a normal-looking front door of smartly glazed panelled wood with a black dolphin door knocker. The one odd thing about this door was its doorstep, which was 9 feet high, since the door was set into the upper of the two floors and presumably had been originally used to haul in hay for hungry horses. An old pulley jutted out of the brickwork above the doorway, and it was over this that the rope Arthur was holding was slung. The other end of the rope held a suspended cello. The door opened above his head.
"Okay," said Fenchurch, "pull on the rope, steady the cello, pass it up to me."
He pulled on the rope, he steadied the cello.
"I can't pull on the rope again," he said, "without letting go of the cello."
Fenchurch leant down. "I'm steadying the cello," she said. "You pull on the rope." The cello eased up level with the doorway, swinging slightly, and Fenchurch manoeuvred it inside.
"Come on up yourself," she called down.
Arthur picked up his bag of goodies and went in through the stable doors, tingling. The bottom room, which he had seen briefly before, was pretty rough and full of junk. A large old cast-iron mangle stood there. A surprising number of kitchen sinks were piled in a corner. There was also, Arthur was momentarily alarmed to see, a pram, but it was very old and uncomplicatedly full of books. The floor was old stained concrete, excitingly cracked, and this was the measure of Arthur's mood as he started up the rickety wooden steps in the far corner. Even a cracked concrete floor seemed to him an almost unbearably sensual thing.
"An architect friend of mine keeps on telling me how he can do wonderful things with this place," said Fenchurch chattily, as Arthur emerged through the floor. "He keeps on coming round, standing in stunned amazement, muttering about space and objects and events and marvellous qualities of light, then says he needs a pencil and disappears for weeks. Wonderful things have therefore so far failed to happen." In fact, thought Arthur as he looked about, the upper room was at least reasonably wonderful anyway. It was simply decorated, furnished with things made out of cushions, and also a stereo set with speakers which would have impressed the guys who put up Stonehenge. There were flowers which were pale, and pictures which were interesting. There was a sort of gallery structure in the roof space which held a bed and also a bathroom which, Fenchurch explained, you could actually swing a cat in, but, she added, only if it was a reasonably patient cat and didn't mind a few nasty cracks about the head. "So, here you are."
"Yes."
They looked at each other for a moment. The moment became a longer moment, and suddenly it was a very long moment, so long one could hardly tell where all the time was coming from. For Arthur, who could usually contrive to feel self-conscious if left alone for long enough with a Swiss cheese plant, the moment was one of sustained revelation. He felt on the sudden like a cramped and zoo-born animal who awakes one morning to find the door to his cage hanging quietly open, and the savannah stretching grey and pink to the distant rising sun, while all around new sounds are waking. He wondered what the new sounds were as he gazed at her openly wondering face and her eyes that smiled with a shared surprise. He hadn't realised that life speaks with a voice to you, a voice that brings you answers to the questions you continually ask of it, had never consciously detected it or recognised its tones till it now said something it had never said to him before, which was, "Yes." Fenchurch dropped her eyes away at last with a tiny shake of her head. "I know," she said. "I shall have to remember," she added, "that you are the sort of person who cannot hold on to a simple piece of paper for 2 minutes without winning a raffle with it." She turned away. "Let's go for a walk," she said quickly. "Hyde Park. I'll change into something less suitable." She was dressed in a rather severe dark dress, not a particularly shapely one, and it didn't really suit her. "I wear it especially for my cello teacher," she said. "He's a nice old boy, but I sometimes think all that bowing gets him a bit excited. I'll be down in a minute." She ran lightly up the steps to the gallery above and called down, "Put the bottle in the fridge for later." He noticed, as he slipped the champagne bottle into the door,
that it had an identical twin to sit next to. He walked over to the window and looked out. He turned and started to look at her records. From above, he heard the rustle of her dress falling to the ground. He talked to himself about the sort of person he was. He told himself very firmly that for this moment at least he would keep his eyes very firmly and steadfastly locked on the spines of her records. Read the titles, nod appreciatively, count the blasted things if he had to. He would keep his head down. This he completely, utterly and abjectly failed to do. She was staring down at him with such intensity that she seemed hardly to notice that he was looking up at her. Then suddenly she shook her head, dropped the light sundress down over herself, and disappeared quickly into the bathroom. She emerged a moment later, all smiles, and with a sun hat, and came tripping down the steps with extraordinary lightness. It was a strange kind of dancing motion she had. She saw that he noticed it and put her head slightly on one side. "Like it?" she said. "You look gorgeous," he said simply, because she did. "Hmm," she said, as if he hadn't really answered her question. She closed the upstairs front door, which had stood open all this time, and looked around the little room to see that it was all in a fit state to be left on its own for a while. Arthur's eyes followed hers around, and while he was looking in the other direction, she slipped something out of a drawer and into the canvas bag she was carrying. Arthur looked back at her. "Ready?" "Did you know," she said with a slightly puzzled smile, "that there's something wrong with me?" Her directness caught Arthur unprepared. "Well," he said, "I'd heard some vague sort of..." "I wonder how much you do know about me," she said. "If you heard from where I think you heard, then that's not it. Russell just sort of makes stuff up, because he can't deal with what it really is." A pang of worry went through Arthur. "Then what is it?" he said. "Can you tell me?" "Don't worry," she said. "It's nothing bad at all, just unusual, very, very unusual." She touched his hand, then leant forward and kissed him briefly. "I should be very interested to know," she said, "if you manage to work out what it is this evening." Arthur felt that if someone had tapped him at that point, he would have chimed, like the deep, sustained, rolling chime his grey fishbowl made when he flicked it with his thumbnail. Chapter 19. Ford Prefect was irritated to be continually wakened by the sound of gunfire. He slid himself out of the maintenance hatchway, which he had fashioned into a bunk for himself by disabling some of the noisier machinery in its vicinity and padding it with towels. He slung himself down the access ladder and prowled the corridors moodily. They were claustrophobic and ill-lit, and what light there was continually flickering and dimming as power surged this way and that through the ship, causing heavy vibrations and rasping humming noises. That wasn't it, though. He paused and leaned back against the wall as something that looked like a small silver power drill flew past him down the dim corridor with a nasty searing screech. That wasn't it either. He clambered listlessly through a bulkhead door and found himself in a larger corridor, though still ill-lit. The ship lurched. It had been doing this a fair bit, but this was heavier. A small platoon of robots went by, making a terrible clattering. Still not it, though. Acrid smoke was drifting up from one end of the corridor, so he walked along it in the other direction. He passed a series of observation monitors let into the walls behind plates of toughened but still badly scratched perspex. One of them showed some horrible green scaly reptilian figure ranting and raving about the single transferable vote system. It was hard to tell whether he was for it or against it, but he clearly felt very strongly about it. Ford turned the sound down. That wasn't it, though. He passed another monitor. It was showing a commercial for some brand of toothpaste that would apparently make you feel free if you used it. There was some nasty blaring music with it, too, but that wasn't it. He came upon another, much larger, three-dimensional screen that was monitoring the outside of this vast silver Zaxxition ship. As he watched, a thousand horribly beweaponed Zerzler robot star cruisers came searing round the dark shadow of a moon, silhouetted against the blinding disk of the star's axis, and the ship simultaneously unleashed a vicious blaze of hideously incomprehensible forces from all its orifices against them. That was it! Ford shook his head irritably and rubbed his eyes. He slumped on the wrecked body of a dull silver robot which clearly had been burning earlier on, but had now cooled down enough to sit on. He yawned and dug his copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy out of his satchel. He activated the screen and flicked idly through some level 3 entries and some level 4 entries.
He was looking for some good insomnia cures. He found rest, which was what he reckoned he needed. He found rest and recuperation, and was about to pass on when he suddenly had a better idea. He looked up at the monitor screen. The battle was raging more fiercely every second, and the noise was appalling. The ship juddered, screamed, and lurched as each new bolt of stunning energy was delivered or received. He looked back down at the guide again, and flipped through a few likely locations. He suddenly laughed, and then rummaged in his satchel again. He pulled out a small memory dump module, wiped off the fluff and biscuit crumbs, and plugged it into an interface on the back of the guide. When all the information that he could think was relevant had been dumped into the module, he unplugged it again, tossed it lightly in the palm of his hand, put the guide away in his satchel, smirked, and went in search of the ship's computer databanks. Chapter 20.
"The purpose of having the sun go low in the evenings, in the summer, especially in parks," said the voice earnestly, "is to make girls' breasts bob up and down more clearly to the eye. I am convinced that this is the case."
Arthur and Fenchurch giggled about this to each other as they passed. She hugged him more tightly for a moment.
"And I am certain," said the frizzy, ginger-haired youth with the long, thin nose, who was expostulating from his deck chair by the side of the Serpentine, "that if one worked the argument through, one would find that it flowed with perfect naturalness and logic from everything,"
he insisted to his thin, dark-haired companion, who was slumped in the next-door deck chair, feeling dejected about his spots,
"that Darwin was going on about. This is certain. This is indisputable. And," he added, "I love it."
He turned sharply and squinted through his spectacles at Fenchurch. Arthur steered her away and could feel her silently quaking. "Next guest," she said, when she had stopped giggling. "Come on."
"All right," he said. "Your elbow, your left elbow. There's something wrong with your left elbow."
"Wrong again," she said. "Completely wrong. You're on completely the wrong track."
The summer sun was sinking through the trees in the park, looking as if... Let's not mince words. Hyde Park is stunning. Everything about it is stunning, except for the rubbish on Monday mornings. Even the ducks are stunning. Anyone who can go through Hyde Park on a summer's evening and not feel moved by it is probably going through in an ambulance with a sheet pulled over their face.
It is a park in which people do more extraordinary things than they do elsewhere. Arthur and Fenchurch found a man in shorts practising the bagpipes to himself under a tree. The piper paused to chase off an American couple who had tried timidly to put some coins on the box his bagpipes came in.
"No!" he shouted at them. "Go away! I'm only practising!"
He started resolutely to reinflate his bag, but even the noise this made could not disfigure their mood. Arthur put his arms around her and moved them slowly downwards.
"I don't think it can be your bottom," he said after a while. "There doesn't seem to be anything wrong with that at all."
"Yes," she agreed, "there's absolutely nothing wrong with my bottom." They kissed for so long that eventually the piper went and practiced on the other side of the tree.
"I'll tell you a story," said Arthur.
"Good." They found a patch of grass which was relatively free of couples actually lying on top of each other, and sat and watched the stunning ducks and the low sunlight rippling on the water which ran beneath the stunning ducks.
"A story," said Fenchurch, cuddling his arm to her, "which will tell something of the sort of things that happened to me."
"It's absolutely true," said Arthur.
"You know, sometimes people tell you stories that are supposed to be something that happened to their wife's cousin's best friend, but actually probably got made up somewhere along the line. Well, it's like one of those stories, except that it actually happened, and I know it actually happened, because the person it actually happened to was me."
"Like the raffle ticket," said Fenchurch. Arthur laughed.
"Yes. I had a train to catch," he went on. "I arrived at the station..."
"Did I ever tell you," interrupted Fenchurch, "what happened to my parents at a station?"
"Yes," said Arthur, "you did.
Just checking." Arthur glanced at his watch.
"I suppose we could think of getting back," he said.
"Tell me the story," said Fenchurch firmly. "You arrived at the station."
"I was about 20 minutes early," said Arthur. "I'd got the time of the train wrong. I suppose it's at least equally possible,"
he added, after a moment's reflection, "that British Rail had got the time of the train wrong.
It hadn't occurred to me before."
"Get on with it," Fenchurch laughed.
"So I bought a newspaper to do the crossword and went to the buffet to get a cup of coffee."
"You do the crossword?"
"Yes."
"Which one?"
The Guardian, usually."
"I think it tries to be too cute. I prefer the Times. Did you solve it?"
"What?"
"The crossword and the Guardian."
"I haven't had a chance to look at it yet," said Arthur. "I'm still trying to buy the coffee."
"All right, then, buy the coffee."
"I'm buying it. I'm also," said Arthur, "buying some biscuits."
"What sort?"
"Rich tea."
"Good choice."
"I like them." Laden with all these new possessions, I go and sit at a table. And don't ask me what the table was like, because this is some time ago and I can't remember. It was probably round.
All right.
End of side 5.